Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, May 14th. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today. We welcome back Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson to talk about the subject with you. Venus is putting on a show. I just saw that there may be some northern lights tonight, late and then into tomorrow morning. We'll see. Probably be cloudy because that's the way it rolls. The number to call if you have an astronomy question, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. It's Astronomy, Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, and your calls and emails coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today, and it's always exciting for me personally to do this topic, and I hope you enjoy it too. We have lots to talk about with Dr. Valerie Rapson, Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her PhD in Astrophysical Science and Technology at RIT. Bob Berman has written over 24 books, I think, by this point. He is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. He's been on David Letterman. He's been on national TV. He's a big deal. If you have a question for the astronomers, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, how are we?
Oh, I'm good, and I appreciate that you boosted my authorship to 24
no,
books.
No, it's not 24.
No, it's been one. It's 12 books. But if you really want to give me a promotion, you can give me an honorary PhD so I can match Valerie here.
Ah, all right. Well, you know, I hereby bestow a PhD upon you. Valerie, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's finals week wrapping up with the semester
and
here.
And you came anyway.
I came anyways. Yes, I have a pile of grading to do tomorrow, but today is all about the radio show.
All right. Well, it's so great to have you here. And I mentioned at the top of the show that from what I saw on space.com a little while ago, moderate to large sunspots, northern lights possible as far south as New York today. But I think it's going to be cloudy.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the
forecast. For most of us, yeah, it's looking like it's going to be a rainy, cloudy evening. But, you know, we're at solar maximum now. So these kind of things happen more often.
Bob mentioned it while we were talking before the show that Venus is really starting to pop. Right, Bob?
Yeah. It's great to have stuff that people don't have to have any knowledge, any charts, any you know, constellation stuff in front of them. And everyone's noticing it. And unfortunately, we're getting UFO reports. Everyone does at this time of year. Ray's throwing his hands up because he knows those are the words that start the phone ringing.
It's okay. It's all right.
We'd rather
it's
not.
Fine. I got a UFO show coming with Dr. Kevin Knuth in early July 2nd. So, I mean, we could hold off.
But yeah, that's Venus. And here's the thing. Keep watching, because in its orbit, so on the far side of the sun, but as it moves around the sun at about 22 miles a second, by the way, it's faster than us, watch it get closer and closer. It's the brightest thing in the sky, except for the moon at night. Watch it approach the second brightest thing, which is Jupiter. Jupiter's to its upper left, and in the weeks to come, you're going to see them get closer and closer and closer together until they hang out together in early June. So it's easy, fun astronomy for everyone.
It's
no telescope needed.
No colors or anything. It's just, it reflects all that sunlight, and it's, well, Valerie, what is the atmosphere of Venus? It's not pleasant.
No, it's mostly carbon dioxide, and it's, you know, 90 times the pressure on the surface of Venus as it is on Earth, so way thicker than Earth's atmosphere. You would not want to be there.
And as I recall, the Russians dropped a few probes on there in the 60s, and they lasted very brief amounts of time.
Yeah, like an hour and a half, I think, was the maximum one. But yeah, I mean, they melted under the intense heat and pressures. There was no way they were going to last long.
Yeah, and if you want to make it even worse, I mean, nature has made it even worse. It's not just thick, hot carbon dioxide, hotter than a wood stove, but the clouds, and it's overcast at all times, are sulfuric acid, droplets. Oof. Droplets, not of H2O, not of water,
right.
Sulfuric acid. Yeah. So if there's a hell,
despite
it being the goddess of love, if there's a hell, that's where it is.
And yet, from what I'm told, millions of years ago, it was a wonderful place that had a runaway greenhouse effect, right?
Mm-hmm. It very well could have been. I mean, we don't know for sure, but we're probably thinking more billions of years ago at this point. But before all of that carbon dioxide got into the atmosphere, it may have been a little bit more habitable, although it is really close to the sun compared to us.
So. And it's a great argument for those climate skeptics who doubt, which is silly to doubt that Earth is warming up because we now have about 420 parts per million of CO2, where we had only 280, by the way, in the late 1800s, and that's going back for thousands of years. And they say, well, how do you know that Earth is getting warmer? Well, Venus, as Valerie just said, the CO2 is creating the classic greenhouse effect.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing on Mars. Mars has a skimpy atmosphere, but what little there is also carbon dioxide, and it does the same thing, makes it a lot warmer.
I'm glad you brought up atmospheres, because I pulled a news story. Astronomers believe they've detected an atmosphere around a tiny icy world beyond Pluto. I'll read a little of the AP copy. A new study suggests that a tiny icy world beyond Pluto harbors a thin, delicate atmosphere. It's believed to be the smallest object yet with a clearly detected global atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Japanese astronomers reported, I think earlier this month, maybe late last month, that a mini Pluto, just 300 miles across, appears to have an atmosphere. It's 5 million to 10 million times thinner than the Earth's. They say it could have been created by volcanic eruptions or possibly a comet strike. And the scientists used telescopes in Japan to observe the object 2 years ago in the solar system's Kuiper Belt. So let's talk about atmospheres for a minute. Assuming that this thing, however it developed, how does something with that small amount of mass keep an atmosphere?
Yeah, that's the tricky thing. So being so small, there's very little gravity, and the particles that would naturally be in an atmosphere are often moving much too fast for the gravity to hold onto it. So the atmosphere would just kind of blow away into space, essentially. They would leave. So that's problem number one. The second problem is that this object is so far away from the sun that the temperatures are so cold that anything that would be normally gaseous for us on Earth or even around any of the other planets, it should be condensing out either as a liquid or a solid. So it's really strange that this object seems to have a measurable atmosphere around it.
The only thing that favors it is the cold, because, of course, what cold is not a thing. It's a process. Cold means that atoms are moving slowly. They're jiggling or moving more slowly, and therefore they don't reach the escape velocity of even something as pathetically low mass as this object is. So they just can't get fast enough to escape.
So let's talk a minute about Mars. Bob, you mentioned Mars, and it's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Bob, you mentioned Mars and the atmosphere that it lost. And Mars is, what, half the size of the Earth?
Yep, 4,000 miles, roughly, in diameter.
That's still a fair amount of mass. Why did Mars lose its atmosphere?
Well, mostly because of that low mass that you just mentioned.
But we have a 300-mile across item that has one.
Right. But it's 1.52 times the Earth's distance from the sun. That's not like Jupiter's 5.2. It's still roughly Earth's distance. I mean, you know, it's further, but it's warm enough so that it's got enough heat so that, again, its atmospheric atoms, what atmosphere it has. And by the way, when we say why did it lose, it's still got a little, but interestingly enough, it's thinner than ours is atop Mount Everest. So even though we say, oh, it's got an atmosphere, but A, it's carbon dioxide, so you wouldn't want to breathe it to begin with, and B, when it's less than 1% of what we have on Earth, it's not going to help anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So people who fantasize about colonizing Mars, which will never happen, by the way, that's one reason why it'll never happen.
Right. And the other thing, too, is, you know, Mars used to have a magnetic field like the Earth does, but it has since cooled off and there's no longer a magnetic field there. And what that does for Earth is it kind of protects our atmosphere. It guides the solar wind around and behind the Earth, whereas Mars just succumbs to all of this wind coming off from the sun. And those particles will actually energize the atmosphere and rip it off. There's a spacecraft orbiting Mars now that's measuring like how much atmospheric loss we have today. And it's like 0.25 pound every second that Mars is losing today, even, with its atmosphere. So that, along with everything Bob said, is really why Mars just can't hold on to one.
The number here is 800-348-2551. If you have an astronomy question for Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Much more to talk about, and we've only just begun. Let's take a break. Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551. Ray Graff with you. It's Astronomy Today, and we're joined by Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. Another item I picked up in the news, which I thought was pretty cool. NASA's Psyche spacecraft buzzing Mars on its way to a rare metal asteroid. This spacecraft is chasing a rare metal asteroid. It's swinging past Mars for the gravity boost. The Psyche spacecraft will slingshot past the red planet at about 12,000 miles an hour, something like that, tomorrow. It'll be an especially close encounter with the satellite passing within 2,800 miles of Mars. And then it'll be onto the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. And, you know, I don't know, what's the big deal about a metallic asteroid? Can you tell me?
Yeah, they're really the center of leftover planets. So if you think of the Earth, right, our Earth has differentiated, which means all the metals and the heavy stuff has settled to the middle. The lighter stuff is at the top in the crust. And our Earth, you know, did this 4.5 billion years ago, and it happened many times in our solar system. But the asteroid belt is filled with these failed planets, essentially. And this is one of the larger objects, this Psyche asteroid, that seems to be just the core, like all the metal left over from a small planet that never fully formed into another planet in the asteroid belt.
Which is why meteorites, many meteorites, my small collection, I like octahedrites because they're the nickel iron type. It's the every meteorite is a fragment of an asteroid, mm-hmm. and you can see that, of course, they're stony or metal. They're hard stuff. They're not ices like comets are. So, yeah, that's the one type that you can actually hold in your paws. You can hold the iron and nickel, and it attracts magnets too.
Is there any chance that it could be some more exotic heavy metal?
Probably not. I mean, we've already studied this one with our big telescopes on the Earth, and we have a sense of what it's made of. But nickel and iron seem to be the primary things because those are the heaviest metals that naturally tend to exist in a disk around a young star that's forming planets. We don't have a ton of any metals heavier than that. So it would be a real surprise if it turns out to be anything different.
You know, I got thinking about cosmic rays. I was reading an article about cosmic rays, and is it the Hadron or Hadron Collider? What do they call it?
I think Hadron, yes. I don't know, Bob, you're the
pronunciation
guy.
Yeah, I go from one to the other,
I've heard
Hadron.
Yeah, Large Hadron Collider.
So these cosmic rays, where do they come from?
Well, the ones that we're scared of is not so much large as fast.
Yeah.
The ones from the sun are one thing, but the ones that we get in from deep space that have been accelerated, those are the ones that can really harm astronauts the most.
Okay, and they're going really fast. And if I read this article correctly, and I probably didn't, they have tracked or observed one that was 40 million times more energetic than they can do at the Hadron Collider.
Exactly. That's why we call them UHV, ultra high velocity cosmic rays. And they present puzzles because they're even faster than supernova accelerations should provide. They are.
But there's not a lot of mass there, right?
No. Mm-mm. No. But remember, kinetic energy, the stuff that harms you, the formula for that is mass times velocity squared.
Mm-hmm.
So the velocity is the more important aspect of when you get hit with one of these things. One of these objects, ultra-high velocity, can actually impact a person with the same velocity as getting hit in the chest by a baseball.
Okay, and that's what they said. This had basically the similar amount of impact as a tennis ball thrown very hard.
That's crazy.
One thing in the article I found interesting was one of the postulates is that this came from the nucleus of a very heavy metal.
It was
a nuclei of a very heavy metal.
Could be.
Could that be the case? And where would it come from?
Maybe. I mean, we know that, like, when neutron stars collide, we've seen this through gravitational waves a few times, like, that's what generates a lot of the heavier elements, you know, heavier than iron, gold in particular. So it very well could have come from that process. You know, that's one of the most energetic things that we're experiencing in space. And yeah.
Let me show you. Even when you're talking about alpha particles, you're talking about a helium nucleus. You're talking about a very dense stuff. Get two protons are protons. They're all the same. You get two protons and two neutrons, whether they come from an atom of bismuth or an atom of helium, they're the same mass. But the point is, it's massive enough so that you accelerate that to a near subliminal speed, close to light speed, and you're talking about serious genetic damage and personal damage. Another reason why space travel, or especially colonization hopes, is a tough road to hoe.
Well, what protects us on Earth? It's the magnetic field, right?
Magnetic field and the atmosphere, both.
Yeah, okay. Both.
Why can't you, if you're traveling through deep space for long periods of time, just create an ionization layer around the spacecraft?
Well, that'll only deflect, but it's not going to send away or block particles. Mm-hmm. What you'd need is shielding of like many feet of water or lead or cement, and then you're talking about mass that you don't want to have to try to accelerate to get to where you're going in the first place. So it's
we're going to need some new technology, I think, to really protect us on these longer journeys, right? You know, a few days, a few months, we can survive that, but if we ever want to go to the edge of the solar system or interstellar travel, we've got a ways to go.
Yeah, and it's different from, we used to think, okay, the sun is the problem, because after all, one of the Apollo programs only missed by a month. They missed getting clobbered with a coronal mass ejection that would have spewed many cosmic rays, many much dangerous subatomic bullets into their bodies. But now it seems that the worst stuff comes from beyond the solar system. And the sun, even when it's active like it is now in solar cycle 25, is protective because the sun expands its shield of influence and deflects the really fast stuff that's coming from beyond the solar system. So that has proven to be the more worrisome hazard.
Yeah. It's astronomy on WAMC on this edition of Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson and the construction crew are here. Let's go to Joyce in Brattleboro. Joyce.
My question is that I keep hearing a lot about weather modification in the chemical aerosol operation to counteract global warming artificially. Can you comment on that?
Oh, that's Valerie's specialty.
Well, you joke. I actually, when I was an undergrad, I did a little bit of research with some professors at the University of Rochester on this, because this was like a big thing, you know, back when, I don't know, gosh, it was like 15, 20 years ago at this point, but that doesn't matter. We were basically looking at, you know, what would actually happen to the atmosphere if you dumped a bunch of aerosols in to counteract global warming.
Right.
And the answer was it wasn't good. So, you know, people have postulated this as a theory, but I think the cons outweigh the pros here.
They've been talking about that since at least the 50s.
Yeah, yeah. There's other things that we can do to try and mitigate this, I think, at this point.
We could obviously set off a few nukes and have some nuclear winter, and that'll cool things down, right?
Let's not do that.
Yeah, let's not do that. Joyce, what, you want to follow up?
Okay, thank you very much.
Splendid.
It's still out there.
Okay, well, thank you.
I've got an idea. How about if we encourage solar and wind and renewable energy?
Yeah, I think that's good.
Okay.
How about that idea?
The number is 800-348-2551. We're talking astronomy today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. And let's go. Oh, boy. Are you ready on the volume pot over there, Mike Bowen in engineering? Because Merle can be loud. Let's head out to Argyle and talk to Merle. Hello, Merle.
Hello.
How you doing?
Bob wasn't even supposed to be there you're there.
What'd you say?
I said Bob wasn't even supposed to be there.
What do you mean? Yeah, he's here. Why? What are you talking about?
Well, you went earlier, they said it was just Bauer. Okay.
Oh, no, no, I didn't. No, I introduced them both at the top of the show. Merle, you got to get your sleep, buddy.
No, earlier today, 8 o'clock.
I wasn't on at that hour.
It doesn't matter.
All right.
The question I have is gravitational waves that they proved existed, a year ago or so, and now they're saying that the source, which was 1.1 billion miles away, was two massive big black holes.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Almost identical in size.
Yeah.
That merged together or blew up or whatever. Anyway, the question I have is, how can they determine the size of the massive big black holes?
Yeah.
And that they were almost identically the same size.
You mean based on the gravity waves, Merle?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the answer, right? Is you're detecting these gravitational waves and you look at the strength, the amplitude of the waves, how quickly they are arriving at you, and you can model out what black holes or what objects would have created this.
And it would tell you it would be a black hole X amount of 33 times as big as our sun.
Yeah, exactly. The signals
and
look different.
Two of them?
Mm-hmm. The signals look different depending on what the objects are and how big they were. So, yeah, we've got really smart people modeling all of this, and they've got it figured out.
All right.
Oh, okay. All right. A quick one for Bob, and that is the light that people have been saying they see on the moon, since you're the moon guy. Could it be what the astronauts saw, meteorites striking the moon?
Okay.
And causing light flash.
Yeah,
light
sure. Well,
on the moon.
That's what would do it. And those of us who observe the moon, and I do it, I don't claim to be an expert. I realized maybe 10 years ago when I got my second observatory that I had really let the moon lapse in my life. I from being a teenager, I can, and I still can, point to and name every star in the sky that has a name. That, you know, hundreds of stars. It's actually easier than it sounds. But I didn't know the moon. I didn't know the moon. So it's
the moon.
It's so fascinating to see.
You've never seen one, right?
You've never seen a moon? What are you talking about, Merle?
No,
the flashes.
No. And it's controversial. Observers who claim to see flashes are few and far between, and they're usually either contradicted or disbelieved. So when the Artemis people, I think, supposedly said so, you know, this is a big deal. But in theory, meteors still should strike the moon's surface, and they still should create a flash. So it's not that surprising.
Wouldn't they have some other evidence if a meteor crashed into the moon when they were that close? Wouldn't
you? They must be so small because we'd see difference. We have something since I think it was 2013 that's been orbiting the moon called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, mm-hmm. the LRO. And I invite anybody to go online because it's free. And download images from the LRO, and they are exquisite, and they cover the entire moon's surface, and you can get lost in them. You see the different ears of the moon, the air, and you could eventually get to the point where you say, oh, that must be a crater from the Eratosthenian period because it doesn't have white rays coming from it. You know, there's no limit to how much you can get into this stuff. So download those, look at the images of that, and you get down to like a mile or so across, but you can't get so tiny that you'd capture, as Ray was just saying, that you'd actually capture something that could produce a flash.
Mm-hmm.
They must be just smaller.
Well, and speaking of, you know, collisions on the moon, I saw that SpaceX is going to accidentally crash something on the moon in like a week or so.
Oh, I thought it was in August, but I wasn't sure.
Oh, it might be August. I don't remember exactly when. Yes,
yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, you're probably right, August. But yeah, it was really interesting because it was a couple of years ago that they actually launched the spacecraft to get things up to the moon. And this thing has just been orbiting around the Earth since. And it's finally in this decaying orbit where it's going to collide with the moon. And people were so excited because they thought we'd be able to see it from Earth's perspective.
Right.
We could all point our telescopes and watch it happen. But it's going to be like just on the edge of where we can see the moon. So they're not so optimistic about observing it. But LRO will be able to check out the crater that was left afterwards. And if we send people back, they could look for it, too.
Yeah. And some people dismiss the moon and say, well, with this era of galactic nuclei and colliding galaxies and pulsars and all the exotic things that we can image now, thanks to Webb and Hubble, mm-hmm. Even telescopes that show light beyond what the eye can see, and they go, oh, it's just the moon. The truth is anyone with an inexpensive telescope can see detail on the moon that you cannot see anywhere else in the universe. You'll see a degree of detail, mountains, craters, things that have formed recently, things that have formed a long time ago. And you never run out of things to see, because that the sun rises, that's the first 2 weeks after the new moon, you're seeing the sunrise line, the terminator line, creep over the moon's surface at 10 miles an hour, which means in just one session of a few hours, you see the sun rising over more and more features, mm-hmm. showing more and more detail. And the next month at that same time, if you observe, the moon's is being lit by a different angle of sunlight. So it's never old. The fascination can last a lifetime.
Getting back to the booster that will crash into the moon, the SpaceX booster, it's pretty big.
Yeah.
Now, as I recall in the Apollo years, and by the way, I'll be remiss if I don't give you the number. You can call in 800-348-2551. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson are here. We talk astronomy every month or so. So this booster is pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to smash into the moon. As I recall, in the Apollo era, they sent one of their command modules or something into the moon,
yes.
and it rang like a bell.
Like a gong for up to 2 hours.
Yeah.
What can they study this time, and what will they study this time?
Well, I don't know if we have any of the instruments on the surface functional anymore that would measure this, but by measuring these types of things, you can kind of see what the interior is like, right? You have to have an interior that those types of sound waves can travel through. So we can figure out, you know, if we were able to put seismometers in multiple places on the moon, we could figure out, okay, well, how deep is a liquid layer or a solid layer, and figure out the components just purely by how the sound and the vibrations travel through the inside of the moon.
Is there still a liquid layer of any kind?
No. It's also
probably
the moon has a solid interior, almost like a crystalline. That's why it can ring like a gong for up to 2 hours. But the instruments called ALSOP, that were left by all of the Apollo crews, as Valerie said,
are they still working?
They included seismometers, and that does tell us what's under the surface. Plus, I love the corner reflectors that anytime you shine a laser light onto the moon, which many universities have done, will reflect back back to the source. And so if you time the pulses, you can measure the moon's distance to several inch accuracy. That's how we know that the moon is leaving us at the rate of 1.5 inches a year, because of the accuracy of those measurements, the precision.
So the moon is, the interior is now cold, but we know there are massive numbers of lava tubes,
but
right?
Those are from long ago, billions of years ago.
So at one time it had a core similar to what the Earth had?
Well, I don't know if it was similar, but it was certainly lava at that time. Most of the lava flowed about 4 billion years ago. And all of the maria, the basins that were caused by giant impacts at that time and that are still rimmed basins, they're beautiful. And many of these filled up with lava back then. But lava hasn't flowed now for since the Imbrium period.
Yeah. I mean, it's just cooled off, right? The moon is smaller. The interior has cooled off over time. So now it's mostly solid.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Let's grab a call here. Mary's in Vermont. Hello, Mary.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You got it.
I wanted to partly to thank, I'm pretty sure this was Bob Berman a couple of, maybe last time he was on, he gave a little formula for a little magical number treat with the number 24, the one about the prime squares. That was you, right?
Yes, you were talking about, because I just read, I never knew it, that if you square any prime number, you are going to get a number that's divisible by 24 with a remainder of 1. Every prime number. And how did I reach this age and never know that? That just seems so simple. I mean, give one quick example. Let's use 7 as a prime number. Multiply it by itself. You get 49, 7 times 7. Isn't that a multiple of 24 with a remainder of 1?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't 49...
Yes.
A multiple of 24 with a remainder of 1.
Yes,
and that works up to prime numbers in the millions or any prime number. I think it's very cool. So, excuse me for hogging your call. Please, let's go back.
Yes, is there a question attached?
Yeah.
Well, I've been doing that in my head pretty much ever since, until as big as I can sort of square. And I just do by subtracting 1 and then. So, but I just found that being so random and so precise just sort of blew my mind. The other day I was listening. I think this was on Eye on the Night Sky. That is a program on VPR.
Okay.
They were talking about the precession of the constellations. Is that something that you guys are, at, you know, are?
Yep, 25,780 years. That's how long it takes
our
axis to precess.
Multiple, some kind of, that the rhythm was somehow a multiple of 24.
No, it's 20. It's usually rounded out to 26,000 years, but it's 25,780. You know, if you can imagine a gyroscope when you were a kid, not only does it spin, but when it dies down, it wobbles and makes its axis makes a circular wobble. Our Earth's axis does that every, let's round it to 26,000 years, changing the constellations where they are relative to equinoxes and solstices and all the rest.
Something about the rate of change was a multiple of 24.
Okay.
I didn't really hear it until I heard the number, and then I was like, whoa, wait a minute, what?
Interesting.
So
interesting.
Anyway, that's really helpful.
Well, 3% of us love the number 24. Those are people like me who were born on the 24th day of the month.
I was wondering
where you were going with this. Yeah, I was like, wait, what?
Do you love 24 as well, Valerie?
I guess not, because I wasn't born on the 24th.
Yeah, you know, I'm not that fond of it myself. The number here is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Astronomy with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. We'll check the email bag and hit the phones again after this. Vox Pop on WAMC. Frank Zappa, It Must Be a Camel at 800-348-2551. Astronomy today. Astronomy today. Bob Berman is here. Valerie Rapson is here. An email or two, and then back to the phones. All right, this is a weird one. Josh in Hudson writes, can a black hole participate in a planetary system like our own? In other words, can it be made to orbit a sun? Valerie.
Well, that's going to depend on how big the black hole is. I mean, it wouldn't be crazy, and it's definitely not crazy, to think about stars orbiting around black holes, but we tend to see that in the middle of galaxies, not so much as like a star black hole system with planets orbiting around it. I think it'd be pretty wild and unique. We definitely haven't seen any, but if everything is far enough away so they're in stable orbits, I guess it's not completely out of the question.
And Bob, we've talked about little tiny black holes that are out there, right?
Yeah, mini black holes. Stephen Hawking was particularly interested in those. They can be of any size and they can evaporate. But the nearest general black holes in the constellation of Cygnus, there's the star HDE 226868. You can see it with binoculars.
Okay.
And that's whirling around a something every week, once a week or so. And because it's a massive star, only a more massive object can make it whirl around. So that's the surest black hole. We call it Cygnus X1. But the most interesting black hole, Valerie mentioned the center of galaxies. Center of our galaxy, we have a black hole with the same mass as 4 million stars.
Mm-hmm.
So other stars that are not too far from it, we see in the center of the galaxy a lot of fast activity caused by our galaxy, and probably every other, by the way, having a massive black hole in its center.
Yeah.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Merle mentioned two black holes that smashed together. Wanted to follow up on that question. He said gravity waves. I repeated it. There's a difference between a gravitational wave and a gravity wave, or am I wrong?
No, you're right. Gravitational waves are the astronomy ones. Gravity waves are slightly different. I forget exactly what the other one is, but I make the mistake on accident, too. But gravitational waves are what we're detecting from space.
And then black holes smashing into each other makes sense. Can there be a binary black hole system?
Yes.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's what all of these are until they finally collide with each other. So we definitely could have stable ones that are orbiting out there. Yeah.
Our number is 800-348-2551. Let's go back to the phones. And oh, my heavens, it's Abigail in Kingston. Hello, Abigail. How are you?
Great, fantastic show.
Thank you.
The way I learned the planets in elementary school, I think, was Mary's velvet eyes make John stay up nights period.
Well, you know,
a little inappropriate.
There's all sorts of devices like that. I think the easiest, if somebody already doesn't know it, just to keep it relevant, would be my very educated mother just showed us nine planets.
I like Abigail's better. It's a more saucy. Yeah, it's nice.
You got to get rid of Pluto now. That's the problem, you know? Yeah. Pluto's not a planet. You need a new one.
Okay, my very, very educated mother just served us and then choose a food that begins with N.
Oh, yeah, nachos.
Nicotine?
Nachos. Oh, okay. I like that.
Nachos.
All right. Well, Abigail.
Stay well. And
whenever you're
here. Great show.
Thank you. Whenever you're here, mirth follows, and we appreciate it. Thanks. Let's go to Bill in Hudson. Bill.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering if the guests were invited to do some space travel with, professional astronauts in a rocket ship, would they accept the invitation?
Where my guests go to outer space? I'll tell you this offhand, Bill. There have been a couple guests I wouldn't mind sending to outer space. But Valerie, what would you do?
Oh, no way. No way. I have enough stress on this planet. I am so proud of the astronauts. I love watching them, but I do not have the guts to leave this planet. So I'm just going to stand by and cheer on those with more bravery than I have.
Bob, I know you're against manned space travel, so you wouldn't go, right?
No, I just think the money could be more productively spent elsewhere. I'm not against it, but no, I wouldn't go because I'm not brave. Like Valerie, I'm not afraid of leaving the planet. You know, I'm a 2,000-hour pilot, pilot's license, have my own plane for 30 years or so. So I'm not afraid of leaving Earth. But these people have bravery beyond what I can even imagine. Oh, yeah. These are experimental craft, as the accidents have unfortunately shown. We've had 17 humans now dying in astronaut accidents.
Right. And some of them have been on the launch pad and
right,
such.
Right, right, right. So, no.
Bill, would you go?
I would not, no.
Okay.
You're a good company. Well,
thanks for that, man. I appreciate it. Let's go to Tim in Clear Lake, California. Ooh. What the blue blazes? Tim, you're on.
Hi, Ray.
Go ahead.
I have a question.
All right.
There's theories that the moon may be hollow, may be inhabited by people from other planets as a home base. Now, what if we, by ringing this bell or crashing this into the moon, we penetrate or do something, making them think, oh, you know what? That's an aggressive act. Maybe causing a war? Just a theory.
Wow.
No, that's a good point. You don't want to disturb or aggravate the race of monkey people that are below the lunar surface. And I think that's a good reason not to do it.
I mean, I've read some books on our spaceship moon, Tim, and we could have a long chat over beers, but I'm not sure I'm buying that. But thank you, my friend. Appreciate the call from California. We'll go to Heather in New Milford, Connecticut. Heather, you're on. Or not. Heather is not there, right? Hello, Heather. One more time, going once.
Hi.
Oh, you're there.
Sorry about that.
Welcome.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
So you know how you guys were talking about how the moon is every year getting at least an inch further away from the Earth?
Yeah.
Is there a distance between the moon and the Earth that, the moon will eventually come out of its orbit from Earth? And what will that do to life on Earth?
Right. Well, no, it won't come out of its orbit. It's just the orbit is going to get bigger. And at the same time, the way orbital mechanics work is there's a transfer of angular momentum or a conservation of angular momentum, which will slow Earth's rotation. We're already doing it. That goes along with, hand in hand, with the moon expanding its orbit. And already in about 70 million years, we're not going to have total solar eclipses.
Darn it.
I try to lead groups to see them every year or so. And it's going to be heartbreaking when the moon is so small, because it's too far away, to not cover the sun anymore. And that's going to happen in our future. But there's going to reach a point. This is the good news. It reaches a point where it reaches a maximum distance from us. And at that time, it starts spiraling inward. And at that time, it's the sun that dictates the predominant gravitational effect until the moon goes closer and closer. Our tides get larger and larger until finally the moon reaches its Roche limit, which alone among the people in New York State, only Valerie is following. The Roche limit is about 1.5 times the diameter, 2.5 times the radius of a body if they're the same density. And then it breaks up into thousands of pieces. In other words, we get a ring like Saturn. Won't that be great?
Yeah, you going to hang around for that, Heather?
Maybe some of my answers as well.
Fair enough. Well, listen, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. And, okay, we'll go to Western Massachusetts. Ben, you're on.
Yes. My question is about the magnetic field of the planet that we live on. I understand that it flips about every 10,000 years. Is that true? And what would the effects be?
Yeah, so it is true that our magnetic field flips. It flips in the sun, it flips in the Earth. But for the Earth, it's not consistent. It's not every 10,000 years, and I forget. It's been quite a long time.
It's been 780,000 since
like
the last time.
A ridiculously long time. So we're kind of overdue for a flip if you take a look at historically when it's flipped. And what exactly is going to happen and how it affects the Earth is a good question. You know, we haven't really, as you know, technological humans lived through this, obviously, so we don't know. But what we can say is, you know, it's not correlated with mass extinctions. We don't see any major changes historically on the planet. So eventually it will flip. We might see a slight weakening and then an increase again, but we don't really have a great model for it because we've never seen it with our own technology yet.
Ben.
Yeah, but then the power lines flip too, don't they? The energy system here?
I don't think so.
Well, when you're talking about AC current, it goes back and forth 60 times a second. So it's flipping, but 60 times a second. You know, that's what Tesla introduced, and nothing to worry about. We know only that it happened. They're called krons, by the way. Each time there's a magnetic reversal of the polarity of Earth, compasses, the needles would point south instead of north. And the reason we know it is that ferromagnetic rocks, natural rocks, will imprint the existing magnetic field of Earth on rocks until you reach a certain temperature. It's called the Curie temperature. It's 1,313 degrees. Happen to remember that. When those rocks cool below that point, they will solidify the magnetic field. So we can always tell what it's been. And it turns out there have been many dozens of them over the millennia. More than the millennia. What's the next time scan? Eons, over the eons. But it's been 780,000 years since the last. Typically, and when they happen, it's not like you can have a latte while it's happening. It's typically 10 to 100,000 years while the magnetic field takes its leisurely time in changing its orientation. And as Valerie said, no evidence that it's bad for us. There's no mass extinctions at that time. I mean, pigeons are going to get confused. Scout groups will probably not know how to use their compasses
change
anymore.
Change where all the letters are on our compasses.
You know, you mentioned this record in rocks of the magnetic flips. And what's the average? Now, you said 780,000 since the last one. What's the average time between the flips?
Isn't it like a few hundred thousand years or something?
Alexa, what's the average period
stop
between...
Stop that, because, you know, other people are listening who have Alexas. Cut that out. What I'm saying is, does the extra length of time signify anything? Can we learn anything about our core and about what generates our magnetic field?
I don't think
field?
So, because it's still mysterious. We know it has something to do with the core, because that's where the magnetic field ultimately... You know, back when we were kids, well, I won't put you in the same generic pool as me or age pool. But when I was a kid, they used to teach us that Earth's core was liquid iron and nickel. Now we know it's solid. We have a ball that's about the same size as Pluto in the center of Earth that even spins at this different rate as the rest of Earth, but it's surrounded by the liquid iron, and together they create the magnetic field. Now, why should it flip? you know, experts have scratched their heads over this, but I've yet to see a definitive answer. Have you, Valerie?
I haven't seen anything. I don't think we know. It'll be real interesting if we see significant evidence that we're going through a flip like right now. You know, that would really open our eyes and make us.
Some people are worried because the magnetic field of Earth has decreased by 10% since 1860. Mm-hmm. And also there are anomalous places, especially in the South Atlantic, where their magnetic field is different. There's anomalies in the magnetic field. And some people use both those factors to say, hey, it's about to flip. And the more paranoid among us think, well, that another sign of Armageddon coming. But again, no mass extinctions have ever correlated with Kron's changing their polarity. So it's not something to worry about.
All right. Well, Mars has a little magnetic field or none?
Do they have any global magnetic field anymore? I'm not sure they have any.
No. The last I remember is we can see a little bit of magnetic activity, like primarily in the southern hemisphere, but the global magnetic field is definitely gone, and there's just remnants that
okay.
we see.
Okay. My question is, and I'm sure there are there other bodies in the solar system that have strong magnetic
fields? Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
the gas giants, for sure.
Yeah, they get crazy auroras. You can see them on Saturn and in particular, also on Jupiter.
Can we, and have we, studied possible magnetic field reversals? I know we've seen it on the sun, but what about on other planets?
Oh, the sun, yeah. It happens regularly on the sun. But no reversals on
So
on
why
other
are we special then?
I don't think anyone knows.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I mean, and we were just saying how long it takes to do this. We've only been studying the magnetic fields around these other planets for, you know, let's say about 100
years.
Since you've mentioned
Jupiter, Ray, and I've had to do that on my little Sunday morning show. I just taped them here. I've become more sensitive to the fact that all of us seem to say Jupiter with a D. We pronounce it with a D. We don't say Jupiter.
Ah.
And I don't think we can help it. It sounds affected a little bit to say Jupiter, right?
Look at the time. Really, we're going to go there now? Gee, what the heck is going on?
Right. Never mind that.
All right. All right, so we have a minute, 2 minutes left here, and Nick wrote in earlier today. And, you know, I met Nick at the Landis Arboretum when we did the live gardening show. Great guy. Some of his questions can be a little orbital, okay? And so this one's orbiting. Nick writes, this was talked about on the astronomy show, so I'm not totally reaching for the stars. The idea that reality changes when there's an observer is becoming more and more apparent in real life. I call it the yard sale paradox. If a person sees a yard sale and doesn't stop, it will have existed, but not in memory. If a person stops and gets a useful item that is used regularly, that yard sale becomes an integral part of everyday life from then on. What I'm really wondering now is, could it be predetermined or quote-unquote fate? Are there a limited archetype personalities to where fate would be inevitable, like the person who's always late or someone who's obsessively passionate about one job, hobby, pastime, whatever? Nick.
I'll say that I am definitely one of those people that needs the bumper sticker that says I break for yard sales, because I definitely do. Like, I'm on board with that part.
But when you bring up fate, you bring up a relevant point, because before the show we were talking about this being the anniversary of Einstein's sudden leap to fame, because it was in late May, we're talking about way back in 1918, if I remember correctly, that the total solar eclipse did show that his prediction was right, and that stars in the Pleiades star cluster shifted because of the curvature of space. So there really is...
How does that have anything to do with what Nick said?
Nick? Who is Nick?
Oh, for Pete's sake. Oh, gosh.
We've lost the show.
All right. Well, you know what? I think this is a great time to call it a day here. Bob Berman, if people want to find out what's going on with you and your travels and your tours, etc., how do they do it?
Thanks. Spain solar eclipse. Say Bob Berman tours. That'll just take you to the right place.
Okay. And now Valerie Rapson, you mentioned that it's now almost done.
Almost.
Finals
almost.
Week. How many more do you have to administer to
the
young stamps?
I am done administering finals. That was all yesterday. I just have to grade them all tomorrow.
And then summer vacation begins?
Then summer vacation,
What do you do on summer? Do you relax, get a hammock, and just veg out?
I get out at that telescope and do some observing. That's the best part of summer vacation.
Well, thank you both for being here. Support comes from Bonham and Douglas Architects and Architecture and Interior Design Studio, designing and retail buildings like River Valley Co-op in East Hampton, Massachusetts, bd-arc. www.voxpop.com. Thanks again to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. Sorry if we didn't get to yours. We'll do it again next month. Thanks to our engineer, Mike Bowen. Did a wonderful job. Your calls were answered by Susie Chekai, who also did a wonderful job. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's 2 p.m. Food Friday, and we welcome back our friend Anissa Wahid of Tara Kitchen. We'll see you tomorrow at 2.